Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Love Marriage.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And this week, we're focusing on an issue that has been overshadowed in the news given other recent events, but it's actually the 20th anniversary of the U.S. opening the Guantanamo Bay prison, which was, I think, really kind of a pivotal moment when America's war on terror took a turn toward what many people
Being
have called
terror.
Violations. Yes, toward what many people have called violations of the Geneva Convention. And to be clear, when I say many people, I am one of the many people.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget about this. And I think right now, you know, we're feeling as Americans very righteous. We're on the side of good and democracy by supporting Ukraine, except for, of course, Tucker Carlson and the former president who are supporting Putin. And that is important. But I do feel like it's important for when we talk about Putin and putting people in prison without charges and torturing them, and we're looking down on him for doing that, we need to remember that we did this and we are doing it still today.
That's why we've invited Mansoor Adaifi to talk with us today. Mansoor was held at Guantanamo Bay Prison for over 14 years without charges, having been released in 2016. Since gaining his freedom, he's won the Richard J. Margolis Award for Nonfiction Writers of Social Justice Journalism. He's also a project coordinator for CAGE, an organization that aims to empower communities impacted by the war on terror. His memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, was released in August 2021. Mansoor, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
The first thing that I want to do as an American citizen is apologize to you. It's not enough, but I want to start there. What happened to you and what you recount in unforgettable detail in your book was wrong and diabolical. And I opposed the government about that war and the creation of that base, but I opposed almost everything the government was doing at that time, but it's not enough. Just to oppose, and I'm still as responsible for that. What happened as all Americans are. So I wish I could have done more to stop it.
You know, what neither is many people who always we're like, we are sorry, or apologizing. I mean, we don't hold anyone accountable for what happened to us, except from those who are responsible for what happened to us. So, and I don't think George W. Bush and his gang stand or speak behalf of all Americans. Yeah, that's it. So you have nothing to apologize about. So we understand, you know, those people, you know, acting, I don't think, like, based on the American values or principles.
Mansoor, you have a very beautiful passage early in the book about your life in Yemen before you were kidnapped, as you term it, by the U.S. government. And I particularly love the way that you describe going to the city of Sana'a and seeing houses with electric lights for the first time. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about that time in your life.
Yeah, it was one of the beautiful moments in my life, moving from a small village where, you know, separated areas from the city is far away. No electricity, no basic surface there. It was my first time to go to the city. It's the first time to see too much buildings, lights, streets, a lot of cars, people. It was, you know, it was really another world for me. So it was so beautiful. It's been like the first week just walking around, just enjoying the scenery, talking to people. Because I lived in really, tribal area where there is no any kind of like basic surface like water or electricity or anything. So, and also small village. When you move to that city, see, especially at night, see these lights, people, cars. You know, I never imagined that in my life. Just, it happened all of a sudden, So, yeah.
I'm going to read a passage from the book. We like to have people read, and you asked if we would read it. So I'm going to go right ahead and read a passage because I think it's very beautifully written, and I want the audience to be able to hear it. So this is from early on in the book, describing this time that you're just talking about now. I remember my first day of school and being so afraid. I'd never been in the neighboring village and couldn't believe how big it was and how many people were there. It wasn't that much bigger than our village, but to me it was a different world. The school was just a small room with dirt floors beside the mosque where every teacher had a stick to smack unruly kids. The first day I went, I was told to line up by the door before going to class, and the teacher hit me on the hand when I didn't. I told him I wouldn't line up if he was going to strike me like that, and he hit me again. I picked up a rock to throw it at him, and my brother came running and told me I couldn't talk back to the teacher like that. I didn't understand why, but I did what my brother told me to do, and when my father found out, he taught me the meaning of respect without using a single word, a lesson I never forgot. I ran with a pack of boys my age at school, just like our tribe, and we always played with other packs of boys. We chased each other and fought when we could, as boys do. I was head of my pack, and the rules were simple, what I thought my father might have come up with: no cursing, no snitching, no bleeding. I remember one day when we were playing and one of my friends yelled at me to stop a boy from another pack from running away. I picked up a rock. I was always picking up rocks, and I threw it at him. I was a good shot, and I hit him in the head and stopped him cold, but I also made him bleed. I refused to tell on my friend. I got in so much trouble for not telling, and finally the other boy came forward and told the story. My mother was so mad at me and disappointed and ashamed. She didn't talk to me for days. I'll never forget that. It broke my heart, and I never wanted to disappoint her again. Rema was my whole world until I left home at 13 to live with my aunt in Sana'a, the capital, the only place I could finish my secondary education. It was my first time going to Sana'a, and also my first car ride. I got so sick to my stomach. It was nighttime when we came over the last mountain before getting to Sana'a. The lights flickering down in the dark valley was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. My brother had accompanied me and explained what I was seeing. These are all lights and houses and stores and streets, he said. They're all run by electricity. I couldn't believe my eyes as we drove down the wide boulevards to the center of the city. What life! My aunt and my cousin, who was about the same age as me, picked us up and took us to a restaurant. But I was too busy taking in everything in to eat, the bright signs and storefronts, all the people in cars, traffic lights, and the noise of the city. It made my entire body hum with excitement. I wanted to stay out all night and see everything, but my cousin was bored by it all. This was just his everyday life. There was so much to do and see and learn, and it felt like there wasn't enough time in life to do it all. I had never seen so many crazy buildings in one place. I'd always been curious. In those first days, I walked into buildings all over the city and asked shopkeepers, attendants, anyone who was there, what they did and what kind of business they had. My cousin was so embarrassed and teased me for talking to anyone who would listen. But this was how I learned every inch of our neighborhood. It's mostly forgotten now. I remember that my life in Sana'a was full of firsts. I watched TV for the first time and fell in love with the crazy bird called Woody Woodpecker. I used the telephone for the first time to call my father's restaurant in Saudi Arabia and tell him I got top marks in my classes. His voice was weaker than in person, but still strong despite the distance. I loved electricity. I loved that you could turn a light on and off and not have to light a lamp. I couldn't wait to go home and tell my younger brothers and sisters about everything I'd experienced. You can't know what that feels like if you've never lived without it. My world was growing, and I wanted more. So that's a really fantastic passage. Not long after this passage in the book, and in multiple places in the book, you refer to certain detainees as having been sold to the CIA and ending up in Guantanamo. What was this process? How did it work? And is that what happened to you not long after this?
You know, Guantanamo is a different place. It's not just different because it's different, because the way it was created, the way it was established, and most people who end up in Guantanamo were either sold for bounty money or were mistaken identity. That is also a report for ACLU and Seton Hall University report about Guantanamo. After 9/11, when American arrived in Afghanistan, the airplane were throwing pamphlet, offering
leaflets,
bounty of money. Yeah, yes. So anyone who sold or brought Arabs or foreigners in Afghanistan will be rewarded for thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. In my first case, we were ambushed by one of the warlords while on our trip to Kunduz city to deliver some kind of logistic stuff for one of the hospitals. Then I was sold to the second lord, then sold to the CIA. When I arrived in Afghanistan, there were around 800 men, or 780 men exactly, and You know, age, the youngest detainee was only a few months old. The oldest was 105 years old. And as you know, as according to CLU, that 86%, as we said, either sold for bounty money or were mistaken identity, like in my case.
Sugi, I mean, I don't know how it was for you reading this, but that part is the is one of the most troubling things, that that the CIA was accepting this, right, as a way of getting prisoners, because they just wanted people to be in prison, it seemed like to me. Like, they must have known.
You know, when we talked to them later on, they said the operation was at Guantanamo after 2010, when talking to the Americans officially in Guantanamo. They saying, you know, the Guantanamo, it shouldn't stay that long. It was created as a place to bring everyone there and to, you know, to go through the files and the people there and to identify who is Al-Qaeda, who is Taliban, who is not, and to send people back. This is in their narrative. But when we arrived there, the fact is, when we arrived there, they have no any kind of information or names or photos, nothing about us. So when we were being interrogated there, it wasn't about to find who you are. It wasn't just to prove that you are someone you are not. The interrogator were looking for people. We weren't that people, basically. So the idea is, when I met the first time one of the CIA at Guantanamo, when he tried to recruit me, he said, what I'm going to tell the White House, the Congress? We brought innocent people to this place? Where is Al-Qaeda? Where is Allahu Akbar? Where is Osama bin Laden? I said, it's not my job. And, you know, I have nothing to do with that. He said, literally, he told me, there are always victims of war. Consider yourself one of them. And this is one of the things that hurt me most at Guantanamo. Knowing someone who knows that I'm an innocent, but he doesn't care. Doesn't matter. So at Guantanamo, we were serving as, you know, putting us in this kind of like orange jumpsuit. And I used to tell the guards, we are actually working for the U.S. government. It's like, whether we like it or not, we work as detainees, because they want to tell their people and to the world, we brought the worst of the worst here. Because when the guard left us with years and years, with months and months, they found out, you're not that bad, guys. I said, ask your government.
Yeah, it seems like there's, in some ways, what you're describing about the process of being sold and the incentivizing of turning in innocent people to incentivize turning people in to put bounties on that. I mean, in some ways that's outside the world of the prison. That's like a precursor to things like torture, right? Which is of course so ethically compromising. And then also, right, it produces a dishonest result as well. And so it seems to me like those things are, it's like a whole chain of actions like that. And so you are kidnapped, beaten, chained, you're flown to Guantanamo Bay prison, and then when you arrive, you don't know that. You don't know what's going on, where you are. But now you are very well versed in the history of Guantanamo. So for our listeners who have been avoiding this history, could you talk a little bit about how Guantanamo Bay detention camp was started and why it was opened?
You know, I know, as we all know about 9/11, you know, and the invasion of Afghanistan, they established first prison in Afghanistan, also the black sites, which also was way worse than Guantanamo. I spent over 2 months in one of the black sites. And trust me, one day in the black site, worse than 15 years at Guantanamo. Because, you know, there was no limit whatsoever to what they can do to you at the black site. Many people lost their life. And as you know, the CIA destroy all the evidence, all the materials that were about the black sites. Guantanamo was created outside of the justice system, outside of the law until that place. Got Guantanamo, American Constitution doesn't apply, Geneva Convention doesn't apply, international law doesn't apply at that place. You have no rights until that day. We are talking about 20 years of torture, 20 years of injustice, 20 years of torture. This is what Guantanamo stands for. Stand for torture, you know, injustice, oppression, lawlessness, a few abuse of power. And those people, you know, but when we fight for the closure of Guantanamo, we are actually fighting for the American justice system that has been abused and misused until that day. We're not talking about justice. Have the families of 9/11, have they seen any justice? No. And I mean, this is what Guantanamo, as they claim, that created for, you know, justified it for to imprison the terrorists, the worst of the worst. And I am talking to some of the families of 9/11. They haven't seen any justice. Some of the family of the 9/11 victims, they have died. They haven't seen any justice because simply Guantanamo is a mistake. Guantanamo is, I think, one of the worst places in earth be created by the United States, and still simplifies and encourage other tyrant around the world to create such places. It gives some kind of legitimacy to torture, injustice, oppression, and lawlessness. And it has been used against the United States, whether from Al-Qaeda or other groups, or even by the Russian, when they criticize the United States, look what you do in Guantanamo.
I think that's very important. And right now we're talking all about how, you know, we all support Ukraine and we hate what the Russians are doing, and they're attacking civilians and they are being authoritarian and they're possibly using torture. But it is really important for American citizens, especially now marking the 20th anniversary of this prison, to pay attention to what we did here. And that's why I also think, like, when you're saying, like, we say there were beatings, these things, those are abstract terms, but the descriptions in your book need to be read. People listening to this podcast need to read them so that they can feel and understand really the depth of depravity that was happening in these black sites and at Guantanamo.
You know, it's not Guantanamo, it's not about just beating them. No, Guantanamo was the systematic torture, and Guantanamo actually was turned into what they call a developing enhanced interrogation technique that started by the end of 2002 when General Jeffrey Miller arrived at that time. And if you go and I check who is General Jeffrey Miller, when he finished at Guantanamo, he was sent to Iraq, where he tortured prisoners in Abu Ghraib and other places. Basically, they started constructing interrogation technique or torture technique at Guantanamo. Guantanamo, if you just Google Guantanamo America's Battle Lab, it is a report by Seton Hall University. You can find how Guantanamo turned into be an experimenting lab for interrogators, supervised by psychologists, and so on. This is the truth of Guantanamo. We are talking about 20 years indefinite detention. I didn't think that happened ever in the United States history, that men detained for 20 years without trial, without right, without charge. You know, at Guantanamo, we were accused that they used to tell us, you want to destroy our democracy, our rights. I said, look, guys, but us, why didn't you try us before your own justice system? That you accused us that you want to destroy. I mean, what's stronger than this? They accused us to destroy that. It's like, we have nothing against you, but they want to feel that they are fighting. You know, there was no one to fight, but even the soldiers, when they were before they sent to Guantanamo, they were told, you know, you are going to meet the worst of the worst terrorists, the one who is responsible for 9/11. But when those soldiers arrived and spent with us a few months, you know, the reality contradicts what their leadership told them. And many of them started, like, cooperating with us. Many of them actually become victims of Guantanamo itself, because when they tried to preserve their humanity or refused to take orders torturing people, they were punished. They were also pay price. Guantanamo, it was a test for humans. And I must say, just we were as detainees, we were victims. You know, guards and camp staff, they were also victims of Guantanamo.
I wonder if you could talk specifically about the prison's leadership. You write, and I'm quoting here, "The Americans seemed at odds with each other over the question of who we were. Were we animals and monsters, or were we humans, and how should we be treated?" And that's the end of the quote. "When you arrived, the two men in charge of the prison were General Backus and General Dunleavy, who seemed to exemplify that particular split that you described there." And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
You know, anyway, when we arrived at Guantanamo, it's not like any other prison where there is like a systematic prison system where the people define how we treated, riots, and so on. And this is one of the main arguments with the camp leadership at Guantanamo over and over and over again. When they compare us to the United States prisoners, they said, you guys have a lot, especially after 2010, when we get like a little freedom. The army weren't happy about it. And I remember in 2012, when the army came, they said, you guys have more rights than the prisoners in the United States. I said, excuse me, you are talking about prisoners. I mean, here, what kind of rights we have? You like, they, when they saw us like have TV, we have like 20 hour of freedom. It started in 2010, by the way. So I told him, you are talking about people who have rights, people who have been tried, charged, and they serve time. But here, I have been here for 10 years, 11 years. Can you tell me why I'm here in the first place? What I have done? Can you put me before your justice system? They said, it's not my job. You know, you are talking about, especially when you talk about the military leaders or soldiers, they are trained to be killers. They're not trained to be like, treat you as a human. They're not trained to treat you as like, no, they just, or their concern, security issues, try that you do, that detainees don't escape, they're trying to cause any problems. So when we arrived the first at Guantanamo, there was also conflict between the interrogators groups, because you have the CIA, you have the FBI, you have the MI, military intelligence, you have different, you have NSA, you have different agencies. And each one wanted to treat us differently. Even two generals, one of them believed that Geneva Convention should apply and should be treated as, you know, more prisoners. The other one, no, they should be treated like criminals, and they should be subjected to torture and extracting information. We could see that from the beginning. And when you cut between those two sides, I was so young, and I couldn't understand what was going on. All I see, like, this is so wrong. What happened is wrong because I have done nothing wrong. I tried to find why I was there, until when, what's going to happen to me. And every time new interrogation, every time new leadership, every time new administration, they start to treat you according to their view. Everyone have their own mission and vision how to run the camps. And when General Jeffrey Miller arrived, he actually created what they call GTF, Guantanamo Joint Task Force, where everything should work toward achieving the extracting valuable information from prisoners. And now, every team of interrogation arrive, they will start with us from zero. Actually, what's your name? What's your case? Why were there? And they have their own techniques for interrogation. They call it enhanced interrogation technique, like beating, sleeping, sleep deprivation, raping, you name it. There is no end. And like, there is some people who also, they also created black sites within Guantanamo. Guantanamo itself is a black site, but there are also black sites where people were also waterboarded and tortured worse.
One of the things that was remarkable to me about the book is like that you and your fellow detainees keep trying to figure out the rules. They're like, look, we want to follow the rules. Could you just tell us what the rules are, right? And they keep changing all the time. There's one really moving scene where there's this guy who's like, you had only a certain amount of time to shower, and everyone would like practice on getting the showering done in that certain amount of time, right? And they were going to be told 10 minutes before it was over so they could wash off. And one of the other detainees, like, the guard decides not to tell him when 10 minutes is, when he has 10 seconds left, right? And he ends up covered with soap, and the guard's like, all right, you got to go back, covered with soap, we don't care. And he's like, just tell me what the rules are, you know? That must have been incredibly difficult mentally to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even the guards found it really hard to catch up with the rules, because in average 2 weeks, the SOP, like call standard operation procedure, it changed every 2 weeks. So imagine for 15 years, around like 84 times. And every week, you can like, there is new rules about everything, basically, because everything is about control at Guantanamo, everything. Your sleep, even the air, the talk, everything is about control. So with each shift, they have their own rules. They have their own, you know, they have like each shift, they have run things differently. For example, one of the shifts, they serve you the meal normally. You can get your meal at this time. Second shift, they give you the meal in 2 or 3 hours. They will give you the first cup of milk. After 20 minutes, they will give you like fruit. After 20 minutes, they will take the trash. After 2 minutes, they will give you the actual clumsy of the food. And it just like, it's the point is to keep you disoriented and to keep you like unstable and settle in at that place.
And yet, despite all that was taken from you, all of the different ways that they were trying to unsettle you, you still managed to find ways to resist, which is also, I think, one of the most interesting and moving parts of the book. Could you tell us the story of the protest you helped to organize to get dental treatment for a detainee named Zakaria, who had a tooth that had been broken during a beating?
I remember when Zakaria arrived the first time, I was in solitary confinement. No fumble block. He was so afraid and scared. And, you know, before they even brought him to the blocks, people end up like trip to Guantanamo would take up to 40 or 50 hours beating and so on. It was, you know, part of it to prepare them for the interrogation. When they arrived at Guantanamo, there was someone they call process station where people get stripped naked. They get like searched in the worst way and beating, and they will wait for line in hours and hours and hours. Then they will be also taken to a cold room, interrogation room, was the time like naked. Then the interrogators would come to interrogate you. People don't know what they were saying. So you have to answer the way they want you to these questions, basically. So when Zakaria arrived at the November block, I tried to talk to him. He was afraid because he didn't know who was there or who was the kind of person. Later on, in 2004, he got dental issue because he was beating badly and they broke some of his teeth on his way to Guantanamo. Spent the first day, the second, the third, about trying to talk to camp administration about we need to treat our brothers. He cannot eat. He cannot sleep. He is screaming of pain. And this is the way how we start. We try to talk to someone. We try to find someone who can listen to us because we knew you cannot solve the problem with violence or going crazy. You always try because you are a prisoner and you try to find someone who has like a sense of humanity in his heart. They might understand and so on. And it's the way it is. The way it is. It's like we are just human beings. But we found we couldn't. I mean, no one wanted to listen to us. You cannot watch someone. Basically, I couldn't. I said, I'm not going to keep watching my brothers like that. We have to do something. First of all, we started refusing to take our meals, you know, because treat our brother. I mean, it's peaceful protest, and this is just a message. They didn't care. They were laughing at us. So then we went to the second phase. I mean, then we start like also protesting, refusing to go to out of our cells for search or appointments. Then we start sometimes throw milk or water at the guards and so on. So it's the way it is, you know, the way they treated us, they wanted to extract the worst of us. They want also to keep fighting with the guards. You know, part of the treatment is not a big deal for them to treat one detainee, but also at the same time, interrogators. While he is in pain, interrogators used to call him, cooperate with us, give us some information. Answer this question. Identify this bill on the photos. Give me something to give you something. So basically, you have to pay, and the pay with the information that, again, one of the cases they have, some of the detainees, they couldn't resist. You know, they break. They give them false information. They lied over and over again. I remember one of the detainees, he lied about over 300 prisoners at Guantanamo. He witnessed against them. Many of us were tortured because his accounts. So, like, sometime we started in the protest, you know, gradual, try to have peaceful protest, try to reason with the people. But it's not going to end up unless there is, like, you end up fighting most of the time.
All right, I'm going to read a little section about Zakaria now during this period of time. Guards came for Zakaria early in the morning. Every brother who'd splashed guards was put on food punishment, no milk and no cups for a long time. We didn't mind. Zakaria was getting treated. We all sang to him in celebration when he came back. He smiled big, but his mouth was full of gauze. He couldn't talk yet because of the anesthesia and just went straight to sleep. I think it was the first time he slept in a week. I watched him sleep and studied his mouth. Why would his mouth be so full of gauze to fix one broken tooth? He had a lot of blood still coming out of his mouth. The corpsman came to give Zakaria a painkiller. Now, I cried, why wouldn't you bring him painkillers before when he really needed them? You know I have my orders, the corpsman said. He wasn't bad like some of the guards. We understood that. He had his orders. The corpsman took the bloody gauze from Zakaria's mouth and filled it again with new gauze. After the third prayer, Zakaria was awake. The anesthesia had worn off and he could talk. I don't know where they took me, he said. They hooded me and covered my ears. He said he waited there for a long time before a doctor came with a bad Arabic interpreter. The doctor looked at his tooth and said he had a cavity and bad teeth. But the doctor wasn't a dentist, and the cap didn't have one, so he couldn't do a filling. The only thing he could do was extract the tooth. He told Zakaria to ask his interrogator to be taken to the base hospital, but since Zakaria had stopped talking to interrogators, they wouldn't help him. The doctor spent a long time working on my mouth, Zakaria said, and he kept giving me shots. Show me your mouth, I said. Zakaria opened his mouth, and I almost threw up. There were bloody holes everywhere. Are you crazy? I cried. He closed his mouth. Keep it open. I was really angry. Do you know how many teeth they extracted? Just the one? He asked. Your mouth looks like the doctor threw a hand grenade in there, I said. Stop joking, Zakaria was really scared now. This isn't funny. This is real, brother, I said. I'm serious. Zakaria turned to Gamdan, his neighbor on the other side of the cage, and opened his mouth again. This is madness, Gamdan cried. How could you let this happen? What are you talking about? Zakaria cried. Criminals, Gamdan. Gamdan was really mad, too. Where are your teeth? I cried. Didn't the doctor show you? My mouth is classified, Zakaria said. The doctor told me that if I wanted to see, I had to ask my interrogator. I couldn't hold back my tears. I was afraid that they could do this to any one of us. I called the camp officer and an interpreter. Guess how many teeth that asshole criminal extracted from Zakaria's mouth? Two, you might guess. No. Three. No. Please go on. Five? Six? No. Are you crazy, Mansoor? They took 8 teeth at one time.
The descriptions of the ways that you and your fellow detainees were treated are in every way shocking and appalling. But I was also really moved by the ways that you and others were able to negotiate and fight for, if not right, then clear rules. And for our listeners, I'm putting air quotes around that, with your jailers. Could you talk to us about how conditions changed during your time at Guantanamo?
You know, the situation I call in my book the Dark Age between 2002 and 2010, where, you know, enhanced interrogation technique took place, hunger strike, beating, I mean, you name it. They bought the army, they bought the air force, they bought the marines, they bought the navy, it turned to be, as I told you, an experimenting and training facility for soldiers, for interrogator, for psychologists, and so on. We had hope at the beginning when we heard there's an American-African president who was going to, or black guy who was going to close the detention. And we all wished that he would win and close the detention eventually. But in 2009, many of us were on hunger strike and force feeding. Myself, I spent around like 3 years on force feeding. Some of us 5, some of the brothers 10. Some of them still until there for 15 years in force feeding. And that also classified. So in 2009, when Obama won the election, the Trump administration, they said, okay, what you guys hunger strike for? You are living in 1 year. He said, no, we don't. If we learn something here, not to trust you guys. And after 3 or 4 months, talking to those, the same leadership, like I told him, have you received any orders, instruction to prepare for leaving people living Guantanamo? They said, no. I said, it's not going to close that place, because if you want to close that place in 1 year, you could see some preparation, you could see some movement. There was nothing. And because Guantanamo is our place. We are very experienced in Guantanamo. So we told the brother we're not going to stop the hunger strike unless we're going to negotiate about conditions. Obama sent some kind of delegation to come to visit Guantanamo. And when I met them, their first question, they asked me, why are you wearing the orange jumpsuit? Why are you on hunger strike? Why are you causing problems? And I said, that shocked me. I said, are you serious? You brought me to that place. You tortured me. You beat me. You killed me in that place. Are you telling me why I'm like that? And I thought I'm going to meet some kind of like civilian. They were civilians, but what the Trump administration told them about us, they just believed it. They took it for granted. They said, this guy is a bad guy. He's causing problems. He's in orange jumpsuit. He's in hunger strike. He's doing all this kind of stuff. I said, of course, I do whatever I can, because this is the way they treat us. Anyway, I mean, In their eyes, we were just, you know, detainees or prisoners. You were just always a tourist. I didn't know how they think of us. But I told them about our life there. The delegation made some recommendation when they found Guantanamo wasn't going to close Guantanamo. They want to make it like a little good, you know. So we start negotiating with the Khan administration about our life and the detention. We consulted our brothers. What do you want? Do you want to continue the fight and join us? And there is a lot of people who want to join us because they said, now we are so tired and we need to wait and see what's going to happen. And, you know, we have to listen to our brothers. And everyone, honestly, was so tired. Everyone was sick. Everyone, you know, after 7 or 8 years in solitary confinement. We said, okay, we initiate with the Khan administration about, you know, about everything, about improving, stopping the torture, stopping the interrogation, you know, family communication, community living, news, classes, also, you know, we set some kind of rules about the life in Guantanamo. At the beginning, they were hesitant about it, but there were also the recommendation from the White House they should do some improvement. We took our advantage, and I think we get 90% of our demands. This is how things change at Guantanamo. We call it the Golden Age. And they hated the military. Actually, hated so much seeing us sitting on this table and, you know, asking them to be treated like humans. And that wasn't too much for them to be treated like human. I said, guys, we are human beings. And we asked them about our case. Something should be done in our case. They said, look, we cannot talk about that. We are here to talk about your life in the detention. I said, okay, this is what needs to be done. And American. In America, really smart. When they went to calm you down, they brought nice people. They brought nice camp administration. They brought nice guards. And we spent like 2010, 11, and 12, I call the golden age. But in 2013, everything was changed and even worse than the first days.
Why was that, do you think?
You know, when the army, again, at that time, the camp was under the Navy control. They were nicer than the army. But when the army came, when the army took over in 2012.
That's generally thought to be true, and weirdly enough. People know that about the Navy, that they're nicer than the army. I don't know.
Yes. When the army came in 2012, they weren't happy to see us like have some kind of little freedom. I told you. They started, you know, taking a stuff, they started making things, tightening the rules, changing the rules. And they said, your guys have more pride than the president of the United States. And when you talk to them about, what are you talking about? That's starting 2010. But it was a scary situation because we didn't know what was going to happen to us and until when. So, and we knew something is going to happen. And I told my brothers, look, now let us lie to ourselves, something is going to happen, but we need to do something. So the army came. They said they need to shut down the communal living and to reopen it again because they said your guys in control. So in 2013, they cracked down, they devastated everything, they confiscated everything. And again, we respond with the hunger strike. You know, we lost everything at that time, but we win. At that time, like, and I told my brother, in order to win, sometimes you have to lose everything. And they made a mistake. Before, when we were on hunger strike, they would separate us in different camps, in different blocks, hide us in somewhere. But that time, they would make me a mistake. We were almost like 90% of the prisoners were in Camp 6. So, and we also the red line, we said this time, we're not going to be in the front, we're going to be in the back. Because we need everyone to react. It is time. So our brother was expecting us to, as usual, we said, no, we're going to this time. It's a mistake. So, alhamdulillah, it was almost like 100% of Camp 6 were on hunger strike, except two brothers, they because old age. And it was one of the most successful hunger strike. It led to Obama that announced he's going to close detention again, but he didn't. Then they started, the delegation started, came to Guantanamo to meet from different countries to meet with the brothers. Then they started the PRPs, which like a periodic review board to review the cases. And we started seeing some brothers get released.
So some past U.S. presidents, as you've been mentioning, have openly stated their intentions to close Guantanamo Bay, and some not all, because obviously Bush and Trump notably did not want to close it. And as you mentioned, Obama said he wanted to close it and didn't. And there are still roughly 40 prisoners there. And you are currently working with CAGE, which is an independent advocacy organization working to empower communities impacted by the war on terror. And early in 2021, you and several other former Guantanamo detainees, including folks affiliated with CAGE, published an open letter to President Biden in the New York Review of Books, calling on him to close the prison and outlining specific steps, this 8-point plan to make that possible and to facilitate, for example, safe resettlement for detainees, repatriation or resettlement in a country that would be safe for them. And so we'll link to that open letter in our show notes. President Biden has said that he intends to close the prison by the end of his term in office. And I wonder if you think he will.
You know, we have been fighting for the last 20 years for the closure of Guantanamo and for justice to be applied to Guantanamo. And as you see, it's like 4 administrations, and still open. It's like around 38 ministers around at Guantanamo. Only 2 men have been released since Biden took won the election in 2020. As you mentioned, that we wrote a letter to President Biden, asking him to close detention. It's like a roadmap to close Guantanamo based on our experience, observation, and so on. And also last year, I finished my bachelor degree. My degree was about rehabilitation and reintegration of former Guantanamo detainees into social life and labor market. Since I got out from Guantanamo, I have been fighting for the closure of Guantanamo, fighting for the brothers in Guantanamo and outside of Guantanamo. You know, closing Guantanamo is morally right and it's the best interest of the United States, because that place shouldn't exist in the first place. And it's one of the biggest human rights violations in the 21st century. And I could see many Americans, many organizations, many lawyers calling for the closure of Guantanamo. The war ended in Afghanistan, you know, and Guantanamo is still open. And until when? Until when they are going to keep it open? Like, when you talk about, I'm talking about the money that's spent about Guantanamo, which is around like $500 million every year. And only 38 men, around like 20 of them have been approved for release. Only 18, two of them, like one of them actually convicted, or two of them actually now. When we talk to the lawyer about Guantanamo case, it's like going in a loop. Because as we said, speak before, it's lacked to the basic for justice. So the government keeps change the rules over and over again when they come to trials or military commissions and so on. So we wrote a letter that we just, anyone who charged or tried, they should be committing a crime, they should be charged and tried before American justice system, you know. And you know, the problem, they said they don't want to bring anyone to the United States. Okay, you can sentence them and send them to some countries close to their countries to spend their time, or to countries close to their countries. You know, basically, because one of the main issues, they said, if you close Guantanamo, we are going to detain those prisoners. And again, you want to charge them, you want to try them, but you don't want to imprison them in your country. You know, it is just crazy. It's upside down world. They want to, if you can call it justice, because as you know, the CIA torture everyone, destroy the evidence, and it is upside down world. So, but we hope that by the end of his term, the Guantanamo will be closed, and this chapter will be closed forever.
We're about to sign off with you, but I wanted to ask you just a personal question. It's 14 years you were there, is that right? Am I remembering the number right?
Yeah. Around 15 years.
Okay. How do you mentally come to terms with the loss of that much of your life in a place, being imprisoned for a thing that you did not do?
To answer that question, you know, at Guantanamo, I had determined that I will never let Guantanamo change me anyway. Guantanamo part of my life. Guantanamo shaped my everything, shaped myself, my character, almost, because you cannot deny 15 years or in your life in that place. But at the same time, I try to stick to who I am, as a person, as a human, not to let Guantanamo change me in any way. And I take it as a duty to close Guantanamo and to fight the idea of Guantanamo, because Guantanamo, as I told you, stand for, you know, injustice, oppression, torture, lawlessness, abuse of power, indefinite detention. You know, this idea now in many countries and many tyrants use the same thing, you know. The context of terrorism, people can be tortured, imprisoned, definitely detained, you know, and unjustly treated. So we are fighting the idea of Guantanamo. But I can tell you, we have some lasting effect is going to take some time. And some of the scars, I didn't think it will ever heal, because it's like I feel there is a 15 years gap in my life. And still, there's a lot of change in that world. And still, we live a life after Guantanamo. We live in the stigma of Guantanamo. Guantanamo hasn't left us yet. We still live being in Guantanamo, being like used of terrorism, even from the hosting countries, you know, being denied to get married, hard to get married, not able to find a job, or denied basic services. Like, for example, I tried to send money to my family through Western Union. I was just, this week. And the Western Union said, no, you cannot send, you cannot use our service simply because you were in Guantanamo. This is that. So it is something, you know, living life after Guantanamo still hard and difficult, and we try to manage.
Mansoor, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And listeners, we encourage you to...
Yeah, I would like to say...
Oh, please.
Yeah, well... Sir, I would like to say just one last word to the American people, and especially to President Biden. Please close Guantanamo. Please stop the indefinite detention. Stop the torture. Stop the abuse of power that had been, that also abuse of American justice system till that day.
Thank you. Yeah, the word that you keep using that is sticking in my head is lawlessness, because despite sort of the pretense to accountability and justice, it's like a totally lawless place. And we appreciate so much your joining us and talking to us about this. And listeners, we encourage you to order and read Mansoor's searing memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, and tell your congressperson that you don't want any more anniversaries for the Guantanamo Bay prison.
Okay, thank you so much.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Ann Knigendorf with help from the students at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the University of Minnesota. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. We want to give a shout out to listener Sonali Pawa, author of the book Theaters of Citizenship, Aesthetics, and Politics of Avant-Gardist Performance in Egypt. Do we have cool listeners or what? And by the way, I'm reading Sonali's name for the first time. If I'm mispronouncing it wrong, Sonali, write in and tell us how to do it right. Anyway, she wrote on Twitter, may I recommend the fabulous At FNF Talk podcast, which is our podcast, which shows just how fiction illuminates history. We feel so seen. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. And please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, and on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can also find video of this interview at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and on an IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where you can find episodes grouped by topic areas. We'll provide links to all this stuff in the show notes, and we'll be tweeting and posting about it during the week. Happy reading.